Welcome to the Reboot Republic podcast, the podcast that goes behind the headlines and looks at the big issues in this republic of inequality. We are the podcast of solutions and the podcast of hope, and I'm your host, Rory Hearn, and I'm joined today by Dr. Anne Doherty, who's a consultant liaison psychiatrist at the Mater Hospital and an associate professor of psychiatry at UCD. She's also chair of the Faculty of Liaison Psychiatry at the College of Psychiatrists of Ireland. And thanks a million for joining us today on Reboot Republic.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm very pleased to be here. Thank you.
Well, I suppose the reason I got in touch with you was, and to try and have you on, is you did an absolutely fantastic article in the journal .ie on emergency departments and how they've become what you describe as the ground zero in terms of the, I suppose, the mental health crisis and response to COVID. And in terms of that, I suppose maybe you could outline, like, why did you write the article, and kind of what are the key issues that you feel need to be highlighted?
Thank you. I suppose it's complicated in some ways. I suppose the reason is that we're seeing more and more people in emergency departments presenting with mental health crisis. And, you know, while obviously some people do need to be in an emergency department, there are other people that would be better seen in earlier in their illness, or, you know, before it becomes a crisis where they have to be in an emergency department. So I suppose in general, there's been a big problem, I suppose, in making sure that people have adequate care at the adequate at the appropriate time in their illness. And this, I suppose, you know, when we look at the funding that mental health services have in Ireland, it has reduced quite considerably since deinstitutionalisation, which was when they closed down all the big hospitals many, many years ago. But even 15 years ago, we had a great many more beds than we do now. We had inpatient beds for people who needed them. The idea with closing all of these down was that they would be replaced by robust community services, and people who needed care, who needed treatment, who needed therapies in the community would be able to get them at an early stage in their illness, and hopefully wouldn't, the idea being that they wouldn't necessarily need beds. However, yeah, the problem is that there always will be some people who will need beds, and there always will be people who will present in crisis. But I suppose we haven't really adequately explored the model of this community treatment, because it was never really funded to a degree where it would work.
Yeah,
and that was the case even pre-COVID. So, you know, most teams were not at the adequate level that our own policy documents in Ireland recommend. They weren't at the levels that international guidelines would recommend. And as a result, they just haven't been enough to meet people's needs. So people inevitably end up in hospital, which would be fine if we had enough beds for people in hospital, but we don't. And that's another part of the problem. The beds have been going down over the years. COVID, of course, has made things a lot more difficult, because first of all, I suppose, you know, things like community mental health teams, where people would, you know, see their psychiatry teams, which would just not just be a psychiatrist, but also psychology, community mental health nurses, occupational therapists, social workers, the whole team, and sometimes group-based therapies as well. So for certain really complicated conditions like borderline personality disorder, the really effective and the evidence-based treatment are delivered in groups, so things like dialectical behavioral therapy. But with COVID, those sorts of treatments, where they exist and they're not available everywhere, they just simply haven't been available, because people haven't been able to deliver groups because of the very obvious and sensible need for social distancing. You know, you can't bring a whole pile of people into a room. So people have been without those supports and they've been without that treatment. And as a result, we're seeing a significant rise in people deteriorating to a point where they need to come to hospital. And it's quite frustrating to see people becoming that unwell when you know that they can be treated at an earlier point in time. And it's frustrating when there aren't enough beds to actually, you know, pick up the pieces when they do become so unwell that this is where they end up. So I suppose that's my very convoluted answer in terms of what drove the writing of the article.
No. It's quite clear in terms of, you know, what you're outlining there. And what would you see typically in terms of, you know, the situation that you're at now in EDs with people, you know, presenting?
So throughout, I suppose, even in the first lockdown, we continue to see people presenting with significant suicide attempts, presenting with serious self-harm. I moved from Galway to the Mater in August of this year. And in Galway, before I left, we did a very good a database there, and we looked at the levels of self-harm presenting over the period of the lockdown compared to previous years. And we found that while in March and April there were much fewer presentations with self-harm, there was then a massive peak once the restrictions eased in May. So March, April were lower than previous years, but May went right up. And of the people we did see in March and April, even though there were maybe about 15% fewer than usual, they were much more severe. They were much more likely to need more invasive medical treatment. They were more likely to need an ICU bed. So there were people who were really, really, really sick. The same as, and through the summer, we've seen the same thing, I suppose, all around the country. And here in the Mater, we would have seen a lot of people who, would have presented again with very serious self-harm, needing, quite significant treatment, both medically in the first instance, but also from a psychiatric point of view. And often people who were really, really unwell. And you would, I suppose, have hoped that, we might have found a way to manage these problems before they became such a really dramatic and unpleasant crisis, because, ideally we would have a situation where nobody would become so unwell that this would be what happens.
And why did you see that increase, do you think, between March and April and then May, when the restrictions would have been lifted?
We were worried at the time that we weren't seeing people coming into the emergency department who needed to be there. So, the normal people that we would end up seeing presenting with suicidal ideation, with increases in anxiety and depression, we weren't seeing those to the same extent. And I think most people were too terrified to come near an emergency department. So I think people were still pretty, the normal flow of people coming in and out was probably there. The people probably needed to be there, they just weren't coming to the hospital, so we only saw them if they were extremely unwell. And certainly I think things like the isolation that people have had to go through, I think it's been difficult for everybody, but obviously some people with pre-existing mental health problems, and some people have developed brand new mental health problems in the context of being isolated, in the context of the worry and the stress about, trying to avoid infection. And then, of course, people have had bereavements and they haven't had the usual funeral system and the usual community support that goes with it. So it's been a really hard time, I think, for everybody. I think certainly we're seeing a lot more alcohol abuse as well. So we're seeing people coming in with significant problems relating to alcohol abuse, whether it's, due to significant collapses, or whether it's an alcohol withdrawal, or whether it's with brain injury as a result of excessive alcohol as well. So it's kind of manifesting itself in a load of different ways. I mean, we're not seeing more episodes of schizophrenia, but we are seeing people who already have schizophrenia maybe having more relapses of their illness. And certainly we're seeing more of the anxiety and depression, the self-harm and the suicide and the substance abuse as well. So it seems to be across the board. It's a fairly general problem, I think.
And I suppose this is really important that you're, speaking out about this. And I think, our listeners and the wider public, it's difficult to hear some of this, but it's really, really important that people do understand, because we have a kind of general talk about, some would describe it, and I probably one of those that would be critical of government, it's a lip service to the mental health, concerns, when actually we don't fund, as you said, these services properly. But, there's definitely been an increase, and a growing awareness, of mental health, the whole issues around it. But I think the level of detail that you presented there is really important. And particularly, maybe you could expand a little bit on that. Those, you refer to the kind of stresses and anxieties, leading to severe, mental illness as a result of isolation. And maybe you could just describe that a little bit more, because I think that's, it's very significant.
Yeah, it's we are seeing people who become very depressed or very, very anxious. And often people will incorporate anxiety or incorporate worries about COVID into I suppose, you know, existing anxiety problems or new anxiety problems. And we know, of course, that stress is a risk factor for all mental, pretty much all mental illnesses. But this has been a big stress, and it's been a stress that's been without the kind of protective factors. So we, you know, when we think about people who are becoming unwell, we think about the risk factors, but we also think about their protective factors, you know, family support, friends, having that sense of community, which usually, you know, it does buffer people against the full effects of illness. And when that's missing, people really are that little bit more vulnerable to having, I suppose, maybe worse episodes and to have more severe illness as well. So it's been, I think it's been really tough for everyone, but in particular for people who may have suffered that bit extra due to these types of conditions. But you make a very good point. You know, a lot of the funding just hasn't been there the way it should be. We're relying to a large degree on the charity sector to provide counselling and therapy across the board, including in substance misuse. There's, you know, a lot of the rehab centres in Ireland for people to go in and be detoxed and rehabbed from a substance misuse point of view, they're mostly run by the private sector. They're not provided by the HSE. What's provided by the HSE is really quite limited in this respect. And I think that's had a fragmenting effect on the availability of mental health supports for people, because, you know, your community mental health teams are then, you know, the HSE funded community teams are very separate from the substance misuse services that people access, access, you know, via a charity, or the counselling that they access via charity. And a lot of these charities are excellent. You know, Pieta House, for example, they provide an amazing service, and they, I suppose, they probably reach a lot more people than the more secondary care mental health services can. But at the same time, it doesn't feel right that that's not being delivered as part of their normal care, that this is something that's been essentially farmed out to charities when really it should be the cornerstone of their treatment.
And why do you think we haven't, you know, funded these services or valued them, or, you know, to the state taking responsibility for delivery of adequate mental health services?
Well, I suppose I better backtrack a little bit. The state does, I suppose, fund to some degree some of these charities, so they do receive some state funding. But the problem is that because they're very separate in terms of their organisational structure, they don't have the same links with everything else. Now, the Health Service in Ireland obviously lacks a coherent centralised IT system, which is a big problem in terms of people's care, actually, because it means that somebody could be very unwell here in the matter. They could have, you know, presented similarly unwell to, say, the Beaumont last week, but unless we happen to know that and happen to ring Beaumont, we'd never automatically receive that information because it's all so separate. And then, of course, the charity sector are even more separate. So if we see somebody in the emergency department today, we don't know that they've attended Pieta House unless they tell us. You know, and sometimes people will be too unwell to be able to give the full story on everything that they've been through. So it's a problem in terms of communication. It's a problem in terms of patient care, but it also is a lot more splintered, really. And, you know, people tend to do better internationally when all of their care is delivered by the one team, you know, coherently and centrally, and everybody's, you know, on the same page, and they're, you know, supporting the person to kind of optimize how they manage their therapies and their treatments.
And on a wider issue, the whole question, big theme that we look at on this, and a big issue of concern of mine and our listeners, is the whole issue of inequalities in society. And obviously mental health is one area where we know that there's a strong link between it. Would you see that in your work and in your research, that, you know, how would you see inequality in mental health manifesting itself?
Unfortunately, a lot of inequality in mental health manifests itself as people having poorer outcomes. So people, for example, with major mental illness, people with schizophrenia or bipolar, just to name two conditions, they die on average 17 years younger than everybody else. And that isn't necessarily through suicide. It's in the most case because they have a lot of poorer, they have a lot of other health conditions that tend not to be managed as well as they are for other people. So people with these conditions will be at higher risk of having things like diabetes, obesity, lung problems from smoking in a lot of cases. And all of these shave, you know, nearly two decades off their lives, which is absolutely horrific and it's tragic. And it's the one area where outcomes haven't improved. People's outcomes in terms of cancer care, in terms of surviving heart attacks, surviving strokes, those things have improved dramatically over the last 20 years. In mental illness, however, the gap is just widening between people with mental illness and those without. And then within that, there are people who are even higher risk. So people who are homeless, for example, are a massive disadvantage, mainly because a lot of mental health services are catchment area based. So they're based on having an address and they're based on, you know, having somewhere where letters can be sent to. This simply doesn't work for people who are homeless, for example, because they don't have an address for their letters to go to. And there can often be drama about what area do they really belong to, etc., which can get in the way of them getting optimal care. And then, of course, there are other groups, the travellers. The traveller groups are massively, massively disenfranchised when it comes to healthcare in general, but mental health care in particular. And they 6 to 7 times the suicide rate of the rest of the population. So we really are missing something in terms of how we, I suppose, meet the needs of some particularly vulnerable groups, such as, you know, homeless people, people who are travellers, people who are in direct provision as well, are also very, very vulnerable. And I think they probably don't get heard to the degree that they should. These are all big gaps and inequalities. I'm not sure what the answer is beyond, I suppose, maybe using services in a way where they reach out maybe more assertively, because there are barriers to people engaging in these groups, perhaps.
And I think it's important, you know, again, to highlight those inequalities. And because I think an issue in our health services in general is that whole, you know, public versus private and ability of people to pay for access. And particularly, you know, mental health services are one of those where people do pay. And, you know, the issue of access. And of course, the less resources and capacity you have. And I think that's significant. And in terms of, you know, homeless, particularly the homeless population or people you would have seen, you know, how have you seen that kind of compounding, you know, mental health or mental illnesses or that?
I suppose it's extremely difficult for people because, you know, they don't, you know, just even apart from the, I suppose, the difficulties of their day-to-day lives, which are immense and, you know, very difficult, I think, for us to imagine when you're not in that situation. But also even just accessing the treatment that they need can be so challenging. There's a really good homeless mental health service for people with more severe mental illnesses in Dublin inner city, actually. And they're absolutely excellent. And, you know, they go out to the hospitals and they'll cycle around the streets and track people down and, you know, make sure that they're getting the treatment and the support that they need. And that's marvelous. But there are other patients who aren't as severely unwell, in that they may not have a diagnosis, say, of schizophrenia or bipolar, and they kind of fall between the cracks a little bit. You know, the people with maybe depression or personality difficulties or substance misuse, they tend to struggle a little bit more to get any care. And, you know, what we see people coming in intoxicated, you know, suicidal. Often, you know, to some degree, their suicidality will settle once they're sober again. But for some people, it won't, you know, and it all of these factors, you know, it's very easy for us to tell people they shouldn't be taking alcohol or they shouldn't be taking whatever other drugs they have. But, you know, when you are sleeping on the street, I think people will resort to anything to try and make it more bearable. And, you know, a lot of our advice in some ways rings really hollow when people are living in such really, really difficult situations.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, and obviously, of course, the fundamental thing is they don't have a home, a secure home. And you know, what a secure home can do for people in terms of aiding them.
Exactly. It makes such a difference. And it's really lovely, actually, when you see people getting a home and getting that stability again, because you really do see it makes their ability to engage with everything so, so much better. You know, I've seen quite a number of people, for example, who've been homeless for a number of years, but once they get into a stable accommodation, often, you know, a supported accommodation, often again provided by charities, you know, like Focus Ireland or Simon or, you know, any of those organizations that do really, really sterling work in this area. But once they do that, their mental health improves quite dramatically. They're able to engage with their community mental health teams. They're able to engage in substance misuse services. And I suppose their lives are that little bit more bearable, I suppose, because, as you say, they have that secure base. They have that, that, you know, they have somewhere that's theirs, that's their own home that they can retreat to when they need to.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's really, and that's a very important point in terms of an argument for that kind of idea of housing first, people being provided, you know, homes and then services alongside that, rather than this idea, you know, that you access services and then you get a home, that fundamental need. But just on that wider question of COVID, and, you know, where do you see this, you know, how do you see this impact of COVID kind of on our mental health extending out? Like, what sort of impacts do you see kind of on a short term and medium term?
Well, I suppose on a short term basis, I think the next couple of weeks are probably going to be very difficult because of the surge in numbers we've seen over the last few days. So hopefully people will be able to, I suppose, keep well and to access whatever supports they have during that time, even though I know it's going to be very difficult. Obviously, we have the vaccine now as well. So hopefully we have a light at the end of the tunnel and things start to open up over the next weeks to months. But I suppose what all of us are really concerned about are obviously the effects in the more long term on the economic state of the country. And, you know, a lot of people have lost jobs. A lot of businesses have been in serious trouble. And we would wonder about the effect that that will have. Certainly, we saw a lot of people struggling with those kinds of issues in 2008 when we had our last kind of economic difficulty period. Yeah. So we would obviously be worried that might happen again on this occasion. And again, that's why we need to make sure why we need to promote the idea that we have adequate mental health services so that when people need them, they can get them, and that we can, you know, make sure that people are supported in getting through periods of difficulty in the best way that's possible. I'm not sure we can do much about the economic point of view, but we can certainly promote the idea that we need to support people. And back to your idea of housing first, you know, it's such a fundamental difficulty that people are going to, you know, if people don't have that housing, if they don't have the stability that goes with it, it's going to make any economic turbulence even more challenging.
Yeah, and no, you're absolutely right. And, you know, and it's something on a broader level. Then, do you think? I suppose, lastly, you know, what do you think the government should do in terms of supporting mental health services better? And then finally, maybe just for people, and, you know, and I often, you know, react and question about, you know, the individualization of responses. But I do think, you know, given your expertise, you know, is there anything you think people can do themselves as well and sort of being well in the best way they can? So.
Okay. So what was the first bit of the question?
The first one is the government. I'm always, Tony, the producer, always gives out to me for asking double questions, but it's a terrible habit I have of trying to get in as much as I can before you have to go.
No, sorry about that. That's my frustration. So yes, the government, obviously I feel that mental health services need to be resourced to a degree where, you know, that they're accessible, that they're joined up, that people can actually get meaningful care. So, you know, in other countries, 12-13% of the health budget goes to mental health. Here it's only 6%. So I think that needs to probably go up quite considerably before we can provide mental health care that's on a par with other countries and that can probably properly meet people's needs. And maybe then once that happens and once things are done in a more coherent manner, we'll be in a position to make sure that that people get the care they need when they need it. We have too few mental health beds in Ireland as well. So we've reduced we've lost 75% of the beds we had 15 years ago when I graduated from medical school. So the numbers have gone down considerably. They need to go back up. Otherwise, we're going to have this situation where people, when they can't get beds, they end up homeless. They end up, you know, because of deteriorating mental health problems, they end up in prison. And certainly my colleagues in prison psychiatry will, you know, we'll talk a great distress about the difficulties in seeing people with mental illnesses in prison who really have come in with very minor offences, but there's nowhere for them to go to. There's no hospital beds for them to go to. And that's, you know, the bed issue is quite critical. In terms of what people can do themselves, I've just kind of gone from the more severe end of the spectrum to, I suppose, what most people can do for themselves, which is obviously about keeping well. And general, you know, a lot of most people know what it is at this stage, what they need to do to keep well mentally, because I think it's been very well promoted. So people know the importance of trying to minimize stress, to make sure that they eat well and take exercise. And we've certainly seen in the last number of years a real increase in the number of, I suppose, apps and kind of internet-based resources that are really useful in terms of managing anxiety. And there's some really good ones from the Mental Health Foundation in the UK, and also from Headspace in Ireland, or Headspace International, I think. But Headspace is more meditation. The Mental Health Foundation ones are about relaxation techniques, so how to physically, I suppose, wind down your body from that state of anxiety. And that they're really useful if you're having difficulty sleeping, because a lot of the time if you're having difficulty sleeping, it's because you are anxious. And your body needs to kind of wind down to a degree where you can actually fall asleep in some degree of peace. So those are quite useful. I think they're quite useful for everybody. We all go through periods of time where we're stressed. We all go through periods of time where we have heightened levels of anxiety, not necessarily in the territory of an anxiety disorder, but certainly to a point where it might be getting in the way of us living our lives as best we can. So I think for most people, those are the things that really help. Connecting with family and friends in whatever way you can. It's really difficult at the moment when you can't see people. I know I've only seen my parents once in the last 8 months, and I know most people are in the same boat. So it's connecting with people whatever way is possible. And I think at the moment most other people are in the same boat, so most people are very happy to have people reach out to them. So that's probably the one thing that'll make a difference for most people.
And how do you manage it yourself? Because obviously you're seeing a lot of distressful, you know, situations and people, and trying to support them, and working in an ED right now must be extremely challenging.
I suppose we're used to it. You get used to almost anything, and you learn how to kind of compartmentalize and to leave work at work, and to have your own very separate life at home, that the two don't bleed into too much. And that's really the only way. And obviously practicing what we preach, making sure that we are taking it's something that I think is difficult for healthcare professionals as well as everybody else, because, you know, humans are humans at the end of the day.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Anne Doherty, thank you so much for joining me today on Reboot Republic.
Thank you very much, and thank you for having me. It's been lovely talking to you.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely fascinating, and best of luck in all your work, and thank you from all of us for doing the great work that you do. Hopefully we'll have you back at some point, and I know our listeners will find it really, really interesting and fascinating. And, you know, again, you can always contact your TD and highlight the need for investment in mental health services. It's really important that, you know, as citizens of this country and as people, we can take action as well and do something about this. So please do that in whatever way you can. And remind you, as always, that Reboot Republic is an independent podcast. We rely on you to keep going and producing these podcasts in terms of the production, putting them up and putting them out. So if you can support us, go over to patreon.com/tortoiseshack and become a patron for whatever you can. And thank you very much. And we'll talk to you soon.